You see a door. Above the door is written
PC 98.
Welcome to the Doors and Dungeons Retro Gaming Podcast. Today, we have a group here to talk about two things. We're going to talk about the PC 98, and then later, we will be talking about a game called Rusty. So, I want to introduce the group here. We have three wonderful people. We have Skywells, and please introduce yourself.
Hi, and your I'm Skywells.
And your name is?
My name's Thomas.
Thomas, all right. And then we also have Quilshi. Did I say that right?
Hey, yep, that is correct. I am Quilshi, and my name is also Mike, just, you know, normal.
Okay. And last we have Holloway Tape.
Hi, I'm Holloway Tape, also known as Max.
All right. And you, all three of you, are in a translation group. Can you tell me what's the name of that?
46 Oku Men.
Aha, that sounds like a pun.
It is yes. Extremely a pun, yes.
So for
a very stupid pun.
No, I thought it was a good one. So for people who don't know, these are the members of a group called 46 Oku Men, which is a pun on 46 Oku Nen, which means, okay, let me do, I can't do math here. That's 460
billion.
Yeah, 4.6 billion years ago. Basically, if you've ever played the game Evo on Super Nintendo when you were young, there was a prequel to that was made in Japan on the PC 98. Was it made on other systems as well? Was there a PC 98?
Just one, no.
Just PC 98. Okay. And it was called 46 Okunen, which means 4.6 billion years ago, because Japanese counting is weird. So Okunen, nen meaning years, they changed it to Okumen, which would translate to 4.6 billion men. Even though there's only three of you, but it's a good pun. So, I've called you guys here today because I want to, you know, first give everybody an introduction to the PC 98 system. One of my goals with this podcast is to give listeners who maybe don't know as much about Japanese PCs, maybe they've heard of them, maybe, you know, the name is floating around and they think, oh, you know, that's the one that has all the Toho games, or that's the one that has that Castlevania game that nobody ever talks about, but I don't really know very much about it. And I can understand why, because a lot of the hardware is kind of difficult to get outside of Japan. You really have to invest a lot to get into it, or just go the emulation route. So I want to give everyone a really good opportunity to learn about these systems. So let's talk about the PC 98, if you can please help me with that. What is PC 98?
I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's a series of computers. It's Japanese computers. Like, what, the 80s, 90s?
Yes.
Even in the 2000s, I think.
Yeah, I believe they did actually go, well, at least the name went on into the 2000s. I don't know if they were compatible in the 2000s. I think the last, like, fully compatible system was sometime in, like, 98 or something, I think. Anyway, the PC 98 is a 16-bit architecture PC that was done by NEC. We're going to be hearing a lot of them throughout this podcast series. NEC had was kind of the giant of computers in Japan at the time. Their really important model was, you know, first the PC-88, which I believe was just an 8-bit system. And I don't remember what processor that used.
It used a Z80.
It used Z, okay, I thought so.
Yeah, it was an 8-bit machine, Z80, very similar to MSX. But,
right.
NEC eventually became the, you know, they had about 80% of the market share.
Right.
And this is just kind of, I think they had like the 66 series, 6601, and then they had the 8801, and they eventually kind of moved into this 98 as like the next series. And I guess it gets a little confusing because, when people think of like PC-98, they think of like Win-98 and, the branding they used to use here in America and such. So it's very different.
It is incredibly different, even though there are much later on in the series, there are Windows 98 PC-98s, which makes it even more complicated. But basically, yeah, there's a whole sort of evolution of NEC's systems. And actually, I have a really great Japanese book that covers, it's one of those MOOCs, if you know what that is. It's like a sort of a fan-made book that there's a whole small cottage industry of fan-made books here in Japan on topics that are, you know, borderline copyright infringement all day long, but they're great. And I've got one that's just a huge pile of just about every microcomputer series that was released in Japan from the very first one all the way up to the end of the 98 series. I wish I was smart enough to have actually gotten that with me so I could tell you all about each processor and things. But anyway, the 66, and then you go up to the 88, and then you go to the 98. And the 98 is a really big shift from the 88 because you've got 16-bit architecture. And when it first comes out, it's at a time when 16-bit was serious. You know, that's serious money. That's some real hardware power at the time. And so this series spans, 15 years at least?
Longer than that, actually, 35 years. The very first model, I'm looking at this at Wikipedia, so if something's wrong, it's because of Wikipedia. But apparently it's October 1982 is the very first model.
Right. Okay, so 82 to... When do they count it as ending?
Yeah, 2000. But the thing about it that's kind of important to understand is that as IBM started to become more popular and well adopted in Japan, the 98 more or less adopted IBM compatibility. And when they became more IBM compatible, they sort of dropped that legacy compatibility with a lot of the older games and software and peripherals. So you started to kind of see some hybrids, and then you eventually see like a clear drop-off point, usually around, I think, 1996, 1997, that era.
And that's also, the point in which they stopped being as popular, because once they're IBM compatible, they're not, the big game in town anymore, because suddenly they've joined the mass, and they don't stand out as much anymore. And it's also, so it's kind of weird, in an attempt to join the river, they almost got lost in it, if you would. They're like kind of like the big stream joining all the others, and suddenly they're just another part of the river going out to the ocean of computing, I guess you could call it.
It's just a standard, like they just kind of, it was pre-standard, and that's just like anything, anything that was pre-standardized, they just they're unique, and they only run certain types of software or games, and then they eventually develop a computing standard, just like how MSX did.
That's something that I talked about in my previous podcast, is that Japan really held on to this lack of a standard for so much longer than the West did. I mean, the West adopted sort of the IBM standard fairly early on because they knew that it was the only way to get the consumers, on a steady ground where they would actually invest in this, because the consumers were still just too nervous, too confused. And they needed to get something where they could not only compete with IBM and kind of keep them from dominating the market, but also, have a base standard so that the consumers could have confidence. And Japan, it was a good 10 more years before everyone sort of got onto one standard. So you've got this period in the 90s where it's very, very bizarre. You've got hardware that's coming out And it's, some of it is like, this is IBM, you know, Windows, or DOS V is what they call it in Japan. They don't really call it IBM compatible. They call it DOS V. This is DOS V and PC98 compatible hardware. And you're like, oh, that's weird. You know, like, I've got a PCI cards that are, you know, Ethernet cards that are made in, like, 2002 that still say, this can be used on PC98 as well as on... you know, DOS V computer. So it's very bizarre in that sense. But let's get into the game. So to split this in half, I guess, is there's really kind of two good ways to do it. You can split it into the 9801 and the 9821. And that's kind of the best way to split it. So everything that's 9801 is kind of the earlier stuff, and everything that's 9821 and on is kind of the later stuff. So can you explain just a little bit the difference between 9801 and 9821?
Yeah, we were trying to discuss kind of just generally what's different. I don't know if you can say that it's going to be matter of fact, but generally on an earlier 9801, you're going to be limited to some of the, you know, the older games that were made for it, and you typically won't find any kind of CD-ROM based games. Typically on a 9821, you're going to be in the 486 processor. You're going to be able to use either a SCSI hard drive or an IDE hard drive, and usually they came with CD-ROMs kind of standard, and they were more equipped to be able to handle like early forms of Windows, whereas you wouldn't normally be able to do that typically on a 9801 unless you had like one of the, you know, top of the line 9801s. So generally, there was a little bit easier to work with a 9821 over a 9801, especially because a lot of those 9801s had those 5.5 or 5.25-inch floppy drives, and the other ones had 3.5, pretty much standard on the 9821s.
And that's an interesting point too, because for one thing, so there's two really odd things about the PC98 series when it comes to their floppy drives. One of which is that the 3.5-inch floppy drives are not, well, not usually anyway, 1.44 megabytes like they are in America. They're actually 1.2 something. It's not really a consensus on exactly what, I think, but roughly 1.2. Basically, it was designed so that they're the same as your 5.25-inch floppy drive, so that you could theoretically take a game that was on 5.25 and then copy it over to 3.5-inch, and it would be literally the exact same size and everything, that, so that they could be compatible.
Much.
Which I find, in a way, I find it kind of silly, because a lot of the games had copy protection so that you couldn't do that. So it's like, why bother? If you're going to make it so that you can't copy the game, why bother making sure that they're copy compatible?
That's a good question.
The other thing is, they're not compatible with other floppy drives. Like, for example, a DOS V computer, you know, has a 1.44 megabyte floppy drive, or even a 5.25 floppy drive, even if they're the same size and everything, they're not compatible. You can't plug them in and get them to work on that system.
Yeah, I've tried before, and it does not work very well. So when your floppy drive dies, you either have to try to repair it, or you have to try to import a new one, and that can sometimes be about a quarter of what it would cost to get a whole new machine.
Yeah,
at least on the auction prices.
The floppy drives are definitely expensive. I've repaired a couple myself. Fortunately, they're not horribly difficult to repair in a lot of situations, but it is very difficult. And what I've been told is that there's, and I cannot remember what it's called, but there's some sort of like controller chip that's normally built into the system on a lot of PCs, and on PC98, they're not built into the system. They're actually built directly onto the floppy drive itself. And so if you don't have that thing built into the floppy drive, it's not designed for PC98. The system doesn't really know how to read it properly, because it's sending instructions or something to some device that's not there on the actual floppy drive's board, which is apparently why they're not compatible. Not to mention the fact that, unlike Western drives, where the actual drive cable determines which is like the A and which is the B, the PC98 has jumpers to determine which is A and which is B and that kind of thing, or 1 and 2 and 3. It's a really weird system, too. because you're...
Yeah, I think it automatically changes depending on whether or not you have a CD-ROM, or not a CD-ROM, a hard drive in there.
Well,
if you have a hard drive in there, it becomes A, and if you don't have a hard drive in there, then the first floppy drive becomes A.
Actually, the first drive that it boots from automatically becomes A. So it doesn't matter which drive it is.
Okay.
If you put in a disk and you boot from the floppy drive, even if you have a hard drive, if you boot from that floppy drive, the floppy drive becomes A.
Yeah, you're right.
And then I guess the hard drive becomes B, or does it become like whatever's after both of them? Because there's usually two floppy drives.
I think it becomes C. If you have if you have another disk inserted into slot two, or
they go
zero and one. So
I think even if you don't, it does that. So if you boot from the hard drive, then the hard drive becomes A, and then your floppy drives become B and C, which is so confusing when you're trying to set stuff up and you're trying to remember your DOS commands, because this is based on a form of DOS. It's not compatible with the Western DOS, but it's essentially the same commands and stuff for the most part. So you're trying to remember, okay, you know, C:\. Well, C:\ is not going to help you when your hard drive is A, unless you booted from the floppy drive. But then when you boot from the floppy drives, you're usually not going into DOS. You're usually going directly into a game. So it's like so much more complicated than it needs to be. But that's Japan in general when it comes to computing. So what are some of the other differences between the 9821 and the 9801 series?
Yeah, 256 color.
Yeah. 9801 has a lot of 8-color games, and 9821 has a bunch of, 16 colors at once.
And this also becomes a big difference in terms of compatibility for people that are buying the system, because the 9821 also introduces 31 kilohertz as a screen mode for monitors, which is a big deal when you're trying to get this to work with any modern monitor at all, basically. What do you use, Tom? Tom, you have one. Do any of the others have an actual hardware?
No, I'm pure emulation.
Nope. PCIe 8 is the thing that runs in Nico Project 2 to me.
That's all it is for me as well.
Yeah, I've got a few PC98 machines, and three of them are 9821s. I typically use a monitor that's one of those NEC AccuSyncs.
Is that a LCD or is that CRT?
It's an LCD. Okay. Yeah, I don't have a CRT. I never bothered to import it, just because, you know, gosh, if someone were to drop it, then you're out that money. You know, it's just it's a big risk.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the advantages I have of living in Japan, is that I can get them a lot more easily. Okay, so I'll explain this a little bit, try to unpack it. With computer monitors at this time, especially in Japan, you have 15 kilohertz, and then you have 24 kilohertz. And then later on, you get 31 kilohertz. And 31 is generally compatible with most of your VGA monitors. The signal's a little bit different. And some like devices, like upscan devices and things, will have trouble with it. But most monitors, and even a lot of your modern LCD TVs and stuff that have a VGA port, will be able to read that 31 kilohertz. But 15 and 24 are different. They're... there's fewer lines on screen, and it has to do with like the rate at which the screen refreshes. I'm still not 100% solid on all this. What I do know is that it can be really annoying, because another PC, which we may talk about at some point down the line, is the Sharp X68000, which in most people's mind is that Castlevania machine. Or I guess that Konami machine, because Konami seems to have released the most popular games for it. Just like the MSX. And it uses all three modes, sometimes switching back and forth in the same game. Which means that you need a monitor that supports all three modes, which is really hard to get even in Japan. So let's talk about what kind of games the PC-98 had. And for that, I'm going to pull out my lovely book here. This is a book of, how can I say this? This book is called, Bishojo Game Chronicle, which loosely, it doesn't really actually mean that, but what they mean by it is hentai games, porn games, you know. There are a absolute ton of these for PC-98, and some people assume that that's just all the machine was, but it's definitely not.
It's definitely a misnomer, for sure. When I first got into PC-98, that's exactly what I thought it was, too.
And that's what everyone seems to think it is.
Yep.
There's a good reason for that, though, because there really is. Like, I'm looking at this book, and so this book here is a chronicle of games on Japanese PCs, going pretty much from the very first, you know, sexy game ever released on PC, all the way up to about 1998. And over 70% of this game, of this book, has games that were released on PC-98 in some form. That's kind of incredible to think of. But does anyone know, like, what the reason for that is?
I kind of do. So the way that I've been told is, and this is something that I think is kind of told to me by a fellow that's over on Tokugawa forums. You know, he knows a lot about the history of Japanese computing and everything, but I remember he told me that the market in which these machines were sold, where they were really aimed for young men that were, you know, salary men that were working hard, and they would come home and they would use these machines both for business as well as for gaming. And because they were young men that were, you know, constantly working, they possibly didn't have, you know, really a lot of time for dating and things like that. So that's where you kind of get into the thrills of having adult content put in them, because that would be a selling point, because the market was this particular age group and also gender.
That's one of the big differences between the MSX and the PC-9801 is that if you look at the price, I'm looking at the book here, and I'm looking at a PC-9801DX, which is, I believe, one of the models that I own. I own two. I own a 9801 and a 9821. I own one of the very last model 9821s. But I have this DX, and looking at the price, in Japanese money of the 1980s, or, well, this is 1990, but this is roughly $3,000 of 1990 money. And $3,000 for just one computer, I mean, that's as high-end as, like, the highest-end IBMs of that era. So you didn't buy this just to play games. I mean, you couldn't, unless you just were super, super rich and you just didn't care about how much money you were spending. You know, you couldn't do that. It was just not feasible at all. And you look at something like the MSX, which, for example, here we've got the FSA-1F, which is a model MSX that I had until recently. That's $500. So you're talking, what's that, one-sixth of the price? So like a younger person, a kid with a semi-rich family could get into that computer, but they're not going to get into the PC-98 unless they're, you know, they've got some other reason. So it's largely businessmen who are buying these machines. And like you said, they didn't have a lot of time and, you know, that didn't necessarily have a lot of social skills either. So, you know, hey, why not go for the porn games? But that's definitely not all there was. So who wants to talk about some of the other stuff that's out there? Because there really is a ton of other really high-end gaming software that was out there other than these sexy games.
I did kind of want to tag in about the reasoning for there being so much adult content on the 98. And you got to also remember that, yes, you mentioned that these are business machines. These are computers made specifically for businessmen to work on, even like factories and crap like that. There's a ton of like factory software and still active today, 98 machines that are running in factories. But all that aside, you have to remember that at the time, there were things like the Nintendo Seal of Approval, which forced companies to not be able to publish their games on consoles or other machines, things like that, if they wanted to create these adult games. So you have that issue, and you have people that, you know, they see that there's a market for this particular niche to be filled, and there's no rating process, there's nothing to put a game out on the PC-98, so that's where they all went. And since there were so many people that had these for business, then it was the obvious target to send these games out onto that particular machine. That is a huge part of why there were so many adult games on the PC-98.
I would actually somewhat sort of disagree with that. Did someone have something else they wanted to say there?
Well, I was going to say, too, you also have hybrid games where, you know, the focus of the game might be gameplay, but you'll have cutscenes that are adult-oriented. And there's many games like that where, you know, you have a really kick-ass mech shooter, or you have a really cool brawler-type game, and, you know, each game is just, you know, fun to play, but then when the hero is off duty, he's doing something else. And, you know, it's, I think
when
it's
he's
just
off duty,
more like
he's
fan
on
service.
Duty.
He's on duty, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of fan service in a way. And I think it was a selling point for that particular demographic.
That's definitely a good point. I'm looking at my book here, and you've got titles like Rants, which is still, as far as I know, it's still running series. You've got Dragon Knight. You've got games like Steam Hearts, which, if you've never heard of it out there, listeners, it's definitely an interesting title. It's kind of one of those top-down shooters that's apparently really fun on PC-98. I've never actually played the original version of it. I've only played the later ports of it. But
and it has received a translation patch recently.
Oh, really? No, I think I knew that, actually. When was that?
A couple months ago. Yeah.
Okay, maybe I didn't know that. I'll have to look that up and see if I can Mahalito that, as I like to say. For people who don't know, Mahalito is a program named after a spell in wizardry, which is basically a super powerful disk copier for the PC-98. So if you actually have original floppy disks and an original machine, you can take just about any game, as long as it, you know, works in an emulator or something, and you can copy that onto a actual disc and play it on an actual machine without any real problems, which is super useful. But yeah, so Steam Hearts is a game where it's this really cool shooter, a top-down shooter, kind of a, I don't think it's quite, you know, the Danmaku bullet hell kind of thing, but it's fairly close. And then in between, there's all these scenes where there's all these weird sex things, because I believe the storyline is something like there's a virus that's infecting all these anthropomorphic PCs that are controlling the world or something, and some computer virus has been released that's gotten into them and is causing them to go crazy and attack everything, and so your job is to fight them. And something that your two main characters have, there's a male and a female character, at least in the PC Engine version, I don't know about the original, that they have in their DNA or something is like a counter agent to this virus, so they have to fight the actual computer machines, and then once they defeat the machine, they then have to go and have sex with it so that their DNA gets inside and you know, counteracts this virus.
Seems legit.
Yeah, which is, yeah, a totally legit storyline, and really a fantastically unique, I say that with tons of sarcasm, unique way to turn a bullet shooter into a porn game. But then you've got dungeon crawlers like Dragon Knight, where, you know, you got your first-person RPG. There was a lot of those. But I really wanted to say, too, that I don't 100% agree with the Famicom logic there, because there were actually quite a few unlicensed games that were released in Japan that were basically porn games for systems like the Famicom, the PC Engine, and so on. Even the Super Nintendo had a Super Famicom had a few, and they were never as popular. They were never sold in the same stores and so on. but they did get released, and there wasn't as much control over that in Japan as there was in America. So it was a little bit easier for those kinds of games to get released, and there were quite a few. There was a fighter on Super Nintendo that had sex scenes in it, or some at least nudity scenes in it, and then also PC Engine had a few. So I wouldn't necessarily say there's none on those Nintendo systems, but they're very, very rare compared to the PC Engine, which is just a unlicensed, there's no sort of licensing, it's just have at it. So let's talk about...
That's what I was talking about, though, is that there is a licensing system for Nintendo, and there was none at all for... So there are unlicensed games, obviously. I'm not disputing that fact. I know that those foreign games exist. That's definitely a thing that's out there. But there was that element of control over consoles that did not exist at all over these PCs, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good distinction to be made, is that there really is no control with these PCs. And oftentimes, that's to the consumer's detriment as much as it is to their advantage, because there's a lot of really terrible games that are made on these PCs as well.
I mean, yeah, it's significantly easier to make something on your own PC and distribute it than it is to get a software development kit of the Famicom and start making stuff that'll go on a cartridge.
I mean, that's kind of the doujin scene kind of started. Well, these Japanese computer systems. I mean, Toho was a definitely a doujin.
So yeah, that's a good point. So a lot of people that know the PC-98 either know it as that porn machine or that Toho machine. And so now the Toho games, if I remember correctly, they were originally started on the 9801, not the 21. Is that correct?
I don't think we have any Toho professors in here.
Oh, okay.
I play the games, but I don't really know that much history about it. I just know that they were distributed at a convention in Japan, and I am blanking on the name of it.
Was it Comiket?
Comiket, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was.
So for Toho fans, if you want to play the early Toho games, they are PC-98 games, and I believe the first two or three maybe were actually on the 9801 series. I could be wrong on that, but. Regardless, they're close enough that you can probably run them on a 21 anyway. Most people are probably going to run them on emulators because it's really hard to find for one thing, it's almost impossible to find the actual discs anymore. And if you do, it's probably incredibly expensive. But also, the hardware itself is just, it's kind of difficult to find it and get it compatible and everything. So, for most people, it's emulators. And if you're a Toho fan, this is how you should get into PC-98. And I really do recommend getting into PC-98 because there's some really, really good stuff on there for it. But I wanted to ask a question. What is the worst PC-98 game you've played?
Ooh. Well, the worst one that I played, I'm trying to remember the name of it. And keep in mind, I don't really fully understand Japanese, or this maybe have made more sense in context. But I remember it was a adventure game where you play as a man and you're basically stuck underground investigating some kind of ruins, and there's a statue of a man, and there's lots of other female characters and whatnot, but as you approach the statue, let's just say that the statue takes control of you and turns the main character into a woman. And then the woman essentially does sexual activity with herself.
Oh.
And it was a very strange game, and I was not expecting it.
I have a feeling this would be in my book, but I have no way of knowing what it is.
If I could remember what the name of it is, I would tell you, but I can't remember. I was going through a whole library. You have to understand, the PC-98 has 6,000 plus titles. So to go through all of them, it's kind of like you could do one every single day for several years, and just kind of mess around with it. That's kind of what the appeal is too, is because you're always finding new things, and not everything is going to be a shiny potato.
Yeah, there are so many titles, and that's really an interesting point. So I think some of you guys, or at least Thomas, I know, are interested in sort of preservation of software on this system. Can you explain a little bit about that and how you go about doing that?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, what we try to do is, you know, we call ourselves software preservationists, but I guess another way we're just kind of like scanners. We try to collect games that we feel have not been preserved yet. We try to find out if it has been, and if we determine that it has not been scanned and it's not out there on the internet, we try to collect it, try to make sure that the collection that we, you know, that we keep is complete with the box, the manual, the game discs, all of that, so that we can scan every last inch of it and preserve it so that later on down the line it can be found. It's especially important for fan translation scenes, because fan translation teams can then find that material and, one, they can have access to it in case they have questions about the game, and two, they might even be able to translate that too for the player. So I think it's very important, and I don't feel that Japan is quite there yet or on board with it as some of the folks outside of Japan are. And I would go into it a little bit more, but I would say that it's probably a Japanese philosophy in general. I was once told that Japanese philosophy is very much like a cherry blossom or a sakura, where you bloom and you're beautiful while you're in bloom, and then you fade and you die. And that's kind of how they perceive life in general, and I think it's kind of applied to software. It's really horrible to think about, but I mean, one of my favorite games of all time was Panzer Dragoon Saga over here, or Azel Panzer Dragoon RPG. I've been told now that that game is now lost. Like, they have no backup of it. It just does not exist. So you're not going to see a remake of it anytime soon, or an HD, you know, version of it, because all of the source code is gone. It's wiped.
That happens surprisingly a lot, actually. Even now, I think I heard somewhere that the source code for the second Wizardry Renaissance game on PS3 was lost. So we'll never see an English version of that, because they don't have a way of doing it, because they don't have the source code anymore. And that's a game that's like less than 10 years old, I think.
I mean, I don't think that's a huge issue, because the source code to the first Kingdom Hearts was also lost, and that was still remade. They just made it again.
But they took the time to actually remake the game, and the company that did Wizardry would not take the time to remake it just to have an English release of it. But it does happen a lot where Japanese developers just lose the code for this kind of stuff because they don't think anyone cares. And it's weird, because what you've seen is that there really is this ambivalence to preservation, because in Japan there is this idea of, I believe it's called wabi-sabi, which is this idea that everything is impermanent. And you see it a lot in the way things are built around here. Things are not built to last in a... They're built, you know, earthquake-proof and that sort of thing, but they're not built with this idea that in 100 years I will still have this home or something like that. They're built in with the idea that there's going to be an earthquake in 20 to 30 years and it's going to be gone and we're going to tear it down anyway, so why not build it where it's easy to tear down and rebuild later? So even like your temples and things, like there's a Buddhist tradition, I think it's Buddhist tradition, it might be Shinto tradition, where temples are often torn down and rebuilt every 20 years as, you know, in the same way with the same materials and the same knowledge, so that not only are the skills and knowledge passed down to each generation, but that the actual building itself goes through a rebirth every 20 years. And so for Western people who really take pride in our history and like the preservation of our history, it seems like a horrible thing to take something that's been around for 1,500 to 2,000 years, some in some of these cases, and tear them down and rebuild them every 20 years, because it's like you've just destroyed that history. But to them, it's like the knowledge of it existing and the knowledge of how it was done is more important than the actual item. And so you see that a lot with, and it's why people are so cool on like the Famicom Mini or a lot of these sort of like modern day emulations or even virtual console or things like that, because they like the idea of these games but not necessarily the need to have the original version. But that's also changing here too, because you've seen a lot more of the prices for these things going up because people are starting to catch on to this idea that maybe nostalgia, at least in video games, is a cool thing and that collecting is a cool thing. And you've seen a lot more of that. So anybody else have a worst game that they've played on PC 98?
I certainly do. And I wouldn't call it the worst game ever. It's a very niche game, I will say. And it's I've talked to Holloway Tape about it before, and we thought we considered doing it as an April Fool's joke for releasing.
This is a different I know which one that one is.
No. I think it's a different one, actually. This one is called Kaze-e, which is the Pigeon Racing Simulator. So,
I've not heard of that one yet.
So basically what it is and like I said, it's a very niche game, and it's actually, I think it was certified by the Pigeon Racing organization in Japan, this game. So there is that organization still exists. I've checked their website. It's a real thing. But it's basically you pick your pigeon, and you do a lot of like dating sim kind of stuff. Not like specifically the same kind of things, but you raise its stats, and you say, I need to train it more, I need to feed it more, whatever. And then you just kind of throw it at these pigeon races, and you don't control it at that point. It's definitely a simulation game where your pigeon just races other pigeons, and it has like full like pigeon racing circuits that you just send them through, and it's very niche. And I played some, and I'm like, wow, this is not for me. But that to me is the worst for me kind of game, because I'm absolutely baffled by how much work went into it, and that it exists in general, and how it fits into that niche. I don't know. It's bad, but then again, you know, someone's going to like it.
So what you're really saying is that you've just discovered the long-lost prequel to How to Fool Boyfriend. Is that right?
Yeah, that probably. I was about to say. It sounds a very similar premise.
Among all the other crappy games I found, that's one kind of stands out.
I can imagine it would. It actually reminds me of another porn game. I know people are going to come away with this idea that, oh, Michelle, you know so much about porn games. And, that's not exactly the image that I want. But it's kind of unavoidable with a lot of these PC systems. There's a game called, it's Run or something like that. And it's basically this like running simulation thing where it's kind of like, not like an endless runner, but it's very similar to that concept. You have these girls, and they're like a high school running team or something, and they run through these settings of like cities and stuff, and it's just like platforming, like side-scrolling running deal, and you like jump over obstacles and stuff like that. But it's split screen, and so in the top you see the enemy character, and in the bottom you see your character, whatever. And so you like to have a rival high school that you're running against, and there's like groups of girls, and they've all got different stats. So your idea is that you need to try and pick the girl who's maybe got the better jumping for this one area, or the better running against this girl who's, you know, the best runner in the rival team. And so you try and choose the right person for that particular race, and then run against them, and you actually control it with your keyboard. I think the PC 98 version can use a gamepad as well. I don't remember if the 88 version can. But and the PC 88 version is super choppy and slow. Which can be to your advantage at times because it makes it easier to avoid obstacles, but it also takes like 8 minutes to go through a single race because it's just frame by frame going through. But you run through these races and you're like jumping over, you know, like jumping over walls and like jumping onto rooftops and stuff and trying to find like the best path and trying not to fall into manholes, you know, open manholes and junk like that. And like one of the fastest people on your team is this like teenage delinquent girl with like a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, which is, you know, I'm sure she's the fastest racer if she doesn't have asthma or something. But and then afterwards, if you win, you get to have these like sex scenes, like where the team manager comes in and like you get to either have sex with her or with one of the girls in your race team or something. It's really weird. And like the better you do in the race, the more like explicit scene you unlock, which is also really weird. But anyway, it's just because there's like three races per round. So if you win like all three, I think you get like a better scene. But it reminds me of that in the sense that it's just like this running simulator kind of game. So there's just a really ton of really bizarre concepts that take like sex and other traditional gaming concepts and smush them together into one thing. So yeah, this is a weird series, it's a weird platform to talk about because the games that are on it are so unique to everything else. And if we talk about some non-porn games right now, what do you think is probably the most unique and I would say good, moderately good is okay, but you know, good and unique concept that you've played in terms of a non-porn game on PC 98?
I mean, there's several that come to mind. I mean, obviously all the Falcom series kind of got started on 88 and 98, so you're going to have a lot of the older Falcom games on there, which, you know, are very, very good games to play if you've never played them. I'll let Holloway and Kiyoshi name a few. They've been really exploring the system more than I have lately.
I mean, I'm really happy with Insiders, which is an educational JRPG that teaches you computer science, and you're like exploring inside of a computer, and like you have to get a part-time job converting binary numbers, and you so that's a game I'm looking into currently, but it's pretty safe to say I've never seen anything quite like it.
So let me clarify, you have to get an actual part-time job in the game, or do you have to get your own part-time job? So it's not like your part-time job is like, I'm going to take out a job converting binary so I can play this game.
So, like, the story of Insiders, basically, when you start the game, right when you run, like, that first bat file or executable file or whatever, you're still in DOS at that point, right? And it starts, inside of the DOS, you know, visuals, it starts telling you that you've been abducted by the devil, basically, Halton, I believe. I can't remember his actual name.
Yeah, Halton.
Yeah, and he's taking over your computer. So, basically, what happens is you are then sucked inside of your own computer, is the story. So, it's you. And you have to, you know, find a way out. I haven't played through all of it just yet, but the part-time job he's talking about is one of those things you have to do inside of your computer, crunching numbers to get money so that you can, you know, buy equipment and stuff like that. It's an RPG, but it's very good concept-wise. I think later, I can't remember some of the other things later on, they have you decrypting some forms of, like, encoded text and things like that. There's a bunch of different little, like, inside computer things that they do, and I'm pretty sure they do, like, ASCII stuff. Just a lot of, like, basic computer concepts and knowledge taught to the player through this weird story that they have.
So, who made that game?
It was published by ASCII, but it's the product of this one creator named Michiaki Tsubaki. And he did Insiders, he did Insiders 2, which is about, like, computer networks. He did some educational game about, like, touch typing. And then he works on just a more traditional RPG called Stellar Sign.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so, Thomas, what would be your game that you would say is, like, a really standout, unique, interesting game for you?
Cattle Mutilation.
Cattle Mutilation?
Cattle Mutilation. Yep.
Do go on.
It's a game by Onionsoft that, at least I think it's by Onionsoft. They made a lot of really unique games. But this one involves you playing a UFO named Abe, I believe. And you control his flying saucer. And you fly around and you use a tractor beam to pick up cows and drop them on their ass. And it's really quite fun, and it has lots and lots of really funny Japanese English. especially for the cutscenes. They're very like short cutscenes where the cows are talking, and you get this little thinking bubble that the cow's saying something. But some of them are just very standoutish. Like, you know, I loved my old bald-headed farmer. He washed me to make good meats for eats. You know, things like that. It's just, it's really worth your time checking it out.
Wow, that sounds, wow. I'm someone who really enjoys sort of like paranormal topics and things, so that's a really, which everyone hates that word nowadays, but that's a really interesting, it sounds really unique. So for me in particular, I it's kind of hard for me to say what is my unique game, because thinking about in my head what games that I play on the system, I mostly play mainstream stuff. I have a lot of the Falcom games. I have, you know, your Ease games and your Legend of Heroes, or, well, there's a couple Legend of Heroes games, and then, you know, Dragon Slayer and Brandish. And then I've also got some other, you know, kind of mainstream stuff like A-Train series, the A-Resha, which... Is anyone very familiar with that series here?
I actually worked on fixing a translation for one of them recently that was going on Steam lately. So yeah, I'm a little bit familiar.
Oh really? So can you tell me what can you tell me about that? Because I didn't know there was one coming on Steam.
Oh, it's actually been out for a while. I did this like a few years back. It's basically just they put A-Train 9, was it, I think? I think it was A-Train 9 that actually came out on Steam. And then they kept releasing new versions and kind of really messed up the whole release of it in general, but that's on them. But, you know, it was just like the one of the latest versions, and they're just still going with it, apparently, even though they really did not handle their release that well.
So this is a studio called Art Dink, which some people may or may not know. They're really... unique. I mean, if you want to talk about just uniqueness and like charming uniqueness, it's Art Dink. Even their name is just so charmingly silly. It's Art Dink. It sounds like somebody from Doug. It sounds like the neighbor from Doug who is always like, you know, hey Doug, come look at this new thing that I've got. It's so expensive. That's the image that I have when someone talks about Art Dink. But they made this. So they made this series that was really popular on PC 98 called the English translation of it is Take the A-Train. It's A-Resha Deiko. And it's at least one of them was released in the US back in the day on DOS. I think it was the third one. And which I believe it was, what's the name of that company? Was it Maxis, the company that did the Sim City games?
Yeah, it's Maxis.
Yeah.
They actually like cooperated to release this game in English, and it's kind of this interesting fit because they're two games that are very similar in idea, SimCity and A-Train. SimCity is this like city simulation where you're building a city, and roads and transportation are kind of an element of the city, whereas this is sort of the opposite side of it, which is that the trains are the core concept, and the city builds around the trains instead of the trains and things building around the city, which is kind of the SimCity approach. I believe you get to name the train lines. You can choose like what train runs on them. You can design the schedules. You have to like micromanage like when trains leave and come back to like get the best, you know, number of passengers and so on, and be like the most convenient for the commutes and things. And your city, if you're doing it right, your city will sort of build up around your train lines. And so it's this really neat little simulation game, and there were several of them on PC-98. But Art Dink just kept adding stuff. Like, even in the old days, like, the A-Train 4 has, like, the base game, and then it's got this weird expansion thing where you need to have the base game, but you have like an extra disc and you put it in there, and then it copies a bunch of files or something. It's very similar to what an expansion would have been in those days in America, but it was like sold completely separately in packaging that looks like the original game. So you have to like put these notes on it. When you see it in the stores, it has a note on it that says, "This is the expansion only. Do not buy this unless you have the actual game." But Art Dink did that, and then they also did a series called Atlas, which, have any of you played any of those games?
I don't think I've ever played any of the Atlas games.
I think maybe one or two of them got released in America in the past. I don't remember for sure. Because there was some... There were some ports for, like, Super Nintendo, I believe, and also PS1. I think one or two of them got released in America, but I don't remember that for sure. But there was, like, the Atlas series and the Neo Atlas, and they're these sort of exploration games where you send out your explorers to try and, like, discover new lands in the sort of the age of exploration of Europe. And it's really neat because you can sort of, you can build the world your own way by what happens in these sort of randomly generated voyages that you send your people out on. So you send them out to, like, go explore this area, and you, like, map it out in sort of the fog of the world where you want them to go, and they go out. And then they'll come back and they'll be like, hey, we ran into pirates, or hey, we found this kraken, or hey, you know, we found a port. And then if you want to, you can be like, I accept your story. And then that becomes set on your map. Or if you say, I don't believe you, try that again. Like, what are you smoking? And then they'll actually go and take the time to go back out and sail it again and come back. And they might have a different report from last time. And so the world can change. So you start out with, like, modern Europe, but then the rest of the world might be completely different from what you're used to seeing in the world. And if you do it right, you might get these awesome ports that have, like, the best items that you can trade. And you can, you know, trade, like, saltpeter and, you know, some sort of metal. And then it'll create, like, guns, you know, or things like that. And so you can, like, advance technology by trading between different cities. So this is just really cute simulation about exploration. And there's one that was just released called Neo Atlas 1469, which is out on Switch and also on PS4 and Vita, I think, and it's also on Steam. And it is in English now. I think the English version on Steam has been out for a year or so. And then the Switch version just came out a few months ago. And I have that. And it's really fun. So that's another thing that, you know, gets its start back on PC-98. What other games can you think of that got their start on PC-98 that we know things about in the West but didn't know really much about their PC-98 history?
I mean, did you want us to just talk about Evo?
Sure! Yeah. That's a great point. There's other games too, but yeah.
So, you know, the game we mentioned earlier in the beginning, the 46 Oaken and Monogatari, Evo, the Theory of Evolution is what we have titled the... Well, we didn't title it. It's just the straight translation of the name, of the Japanese name, but it's just the precursor to the Evo Search for Eden that everyone has this big cult following for on the SNES. But, you know, that wasn't the first game in the series, quote-unquote. There was the PC-98 version came first, and, you know, no one really knows about it at all, except for, you know, now that we've translated it and released it, it's a little bit more known. But, yeah, that's one game that started definitely on the PC-98.
Well, Mail's another.
A lot of Falcom games, it's kind of technically 88. Yeah, the 88 is kind of the... And it's weird, too, because if you're a Falcom fan, if you like the EEs or, you know, Pop for Mail or Dragon Slayer, Legend of Heroes, those kinds of games, almost all of their PC-98 games, at least up until a certain time period, were released on PC-88 first and then ported to PC-98 right around, you know, a month or two later. It's weird because they're different. They're almost completely different hardware in a lot of ways, but then in a lot of other ways they're kind of similar. So it's fairly easy for them to port them onto PC-98. But some things are always going to be very different. But then some things you can tell it's just kind of like, wow, this is kind of a lazy port to PC-98. Especially like the Ease games. Graphically, they're the exact same. I mean, they're the exact same. And from what I've heard, they even took the music and just said, hey, let's just basically copy and paste this music into the 98 version, and it'll sound roughly the same because the sound processors were all made by Yamaha and fairly similar, even though the 98 can do a lot more in terms of its music than what the 88 can do. It still sounds like the 88 because they didn't bother really upgrading the music for the 98's capabilities, and same with the graphics in a lot of the cases. As it got later on, when the 88 sort of stopped being popular and games were started to develop specifically for 98, Falcom put a lot more effort into it. But even games like Brandish, unless you get like the Renewal series, which is sort of almost a remake or an enhanced port, I guess you could say is the right term for it. They're very, very similar to the PC 88 versions, and they just run faster, basically, and have slightly higher sound quality. Yeah, so Evo is this weird kind of unknown thing. I don't think I knew very much about it before you guys started working on it. And one of my questions that I wanted to ask you guys was, why did you choose the PC 98 to begin working on? And specifically, why did you choose this game to start out with?
I know you want to try do yours first, Holloway, and I'll do mine, and then Skywolves, I suppose.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I'm a contributing writer to Hardcore Gaming 101, and I loved Evo Wizard for Eden as a kid, so I wanted to write an article about it. So I emailed the guy, and he said, hey, have you heard of this PC 98 origin story, that the game before it? And I said, no, I better play that and learn about it. And I had such a good time playing through it, not understanding any of it, but just soaking in the very bizarre imagery and seeing what weird things I could evolve into. And it had a big impact on me. I started trying to learn some Japanese so I could try to understand it. But somewhere in that process, I found a romhacking.net thread where in 2008, someone said, hey, this is a cool PC 98 game. It's pretty cool to Evo. Is anyone interested in translating it? So then you get about 7 years of various people chiming in to say, hey, is anyone working on this yet? And so I check it again a few weeks later, and Skywells and Koshi have posted saying, hey, I'm interested in this game if anyone wants to work on it with me. So I throw my hat into the ring and said, hey, I've never done anything like this before, but I'd love to try to help this happen.
Mine's a little bit dumber as far as how I got into it. I used to stream a lot. I know Japanese because I've been studying it, whatever, learning it, speaking it for, what, I think 10, 15 years now. I don't know the number. It's dumb. But anyway, I used to do fan translation back in the day. I started streaming at some point to both a Nico video and Twitch and all that other stuff before that happened. And I had finally started playing the Saga series of games, and at the time, Romancing Saga 2 hadn't been translated, so I was just kind of interpreting it as I played it. And one of my viewers was like, hey, why don't you just translate the original Evo game? And I'm like, oh, there was an original Evo game? I'd never even finished the first Search for Eden. So I looked it up, and I was like, oh, that's actually not too bad. As far as I just kind of like got it working and played it a bit, I was like, oh, that's pretty fun. And I looked around, I found the same romhacking.net thread that Holloway mentioned earlier, Max mentioned earlier, and it's had King Mike was there, and he was saying, oh, if anyone can translate this, then, you know, why not? And that was in 2008, and I think I found the thread in, hold on, 2015, actually, is when I made my post, and so that's when Holloway Tape found it with me and Skywills, and then the decision from there as to why to keep going with PC 98 only is because, one, we've done a game on it, obviously, and really for me the main thing is focusing, because I know if I don't focus I'm gonna want to do everything, and if I keep break outside of that, then nothing's gonna get done. So that's the main thing, though. At least I am staying on the PC 98 as far as, you know, why we want to keep translating these games. And also there's the exploration aspect, I guess, because there's like Skywell said earlier, 6,000 some odd games or more that exist on the system that no one's ever heard of in the West in general. So, you know, why not start showing people what these things are?
I would say it's also easy for Western people to access it, because once the games are translated, you know, emulation is pretty good and pretty accessible, despite the fact that the hardware is so inaccessible for people.
Yeah, that certainly does help. Emulation is actually not in a bad spot right now for the PC 98.
Has a reputation for being really obtuse, but I think it's unearned. I mean, it's pretty easy once you just grab a font file and get Nico Project running.
And I was going to ask, what is your preferred emulator for it? Because I know there's a bunch of them.
I use different ones for different situations. I use most of them. The only one I always suggest not for people to not use is ANX 86, because it does not NT98 and ANX. Don't use either of those two. Personally, me anyway, I say this because they're not actively maintained, right? The last update for either of those two emulators was in like 2001, 2003 or before. It's been like a long time since anyone has cared about updating those and keeping them, you know, current and working on modern systems and, you know, improving their emulation in general. So don't use those two. But in general, the better ones right now are NECA Project 2, the Windows version, and NECA Project 21 Windows, sorry, they only use the 21, NECA Project 2 FM Gen, and then SL9821, which is a new one that's been actually being developed actively as a like from the ground up emulator.
We have one more origin story, I guess, here.
Okay. So this is Sky Wells, Thomas. I guess I've been wanting to join a ROM hacking team and do some PC-98 games in general. ROM hacking has always been something I've been passionate about, but I didn't really explore it too well until probably a few years ago, where I came up with a community called Heroes of Legend. And our goal was essentially to work on some Legend of Heroes games, so it was our name backwards. And I have my own personal projects that I wanted to work on forever. One of them is called Wonder Wander, and it's a PC game made by Compile back in the year 2000, and it's an action RPG. It's very fun. But I wasn't really making a whole lot of progress because we really it's hard to make progress with any kind of ROM hacking project without a real translator. Yeah, that's kind of key. You're kind of in water unless you have an active translator. And so a lot of those projects kind of went the wayside for me. But I just happened to be searching one day, and I had seen that thread over at romhacking.net, and you know, it hadn't really been getting that many, you know, that much traction. It was just more of a, hey, I want to work on this game, who's with me, kind of thing. And it sat there forever and ever and ever. And eventually, I started seeing some traction on it. And I think it was from Holloway Tape originally. But since I'm a graphic artist, and I can't do translation work, and I can't really do programming work, my interest in it was to kind of assist the project wherever I could. I feel like I can do graphic art pretty well, so I just kind of lent in my services, and we're kind of a match made in heaven in terms of getting together and working really well on this game.
I think that's a really key point, because you do all three bring something very different to this task, which is something that a lot of translation groups don't have. They either have all translators or all hackers, and they're missing some core aspect. And you guys really have all three. Tell me, what you individually do.
Well, I do the graphic design part, and that's really about it. I guess outside of that, maybe as a collector and a hardware owner, I usually seek out the original game, and I try to preserve it, because that's also part of a hobby of mine. And I also do the real hardware tests. So whenever they send a build out and they want to see how it's functioning on real hardware, that's where I come in.
And that's something that I wanted to actually touch upon real fast, too, is that with the preservation, one of your key things that I didn't mention earlier is that you make sure that everything you're doing is accessible to the end user out there in the world, because there's another preservation group here in Japan that has a lot more money and a lot more time and energy towards preservation, but nothing that they do gets sent out to the public. It's like stored with them, and it's really hard to get any access to what they're doing. So they're preserving it almost. It feels like a sort of a, this is preservation for us
vault.
Only. Yeah. It's like a safe vault. And so I kind of wonder, like, whatever happens if there's a fire or something, like everything that they've collected is gone and all their data is gone. And who else in the world's going to have access to that?
Oh, I was just going to say, their standards are a lot higher in terms of, like, I think they want, like, 800 DPI, which I don't have a scanner that can do that, you know? Like, I can do 600 DPI, maybe 1,200 DPI, but they want everything to be, like, very, very precise with, like, a certain codec, color code type thing, and I just, you know, they're very hardcore about it. I'd love to see their work, but yeah, like you said, you can't gain access to it. And I think they're going to eventually release that when they're ready. But if someone wanted to translate a game now and have access to a game that they've preserved, good luck.
Yeah, I've tried because I've had some different things like that, and I've tried to contact them, and I could never get through. I know someone who's actually gone to the place and toured there, a friend of mine who was from Finland.
We all know him.
Yeah.
It's MP83.
Well, I was going to keep him secret there for a second, but I can edit that out anyway. He doesn't care, probably. Anyway, I know he's been there and seen it and talked to the guy. And I tried to contact through him and still didn't have any ability to do so. And I even wanted to, like, help, you know, donate and that kind of thing, but I just don't get any information back from him, and I'm kind of like,
Joseph
why?
Redden. I believe he's on Facebook, Joseph Redden.
Yeah, I've contacted him directly through several different means and not getting gotten too, any, too much there, but I don't want to get too in deep into him because I don't want to bash him. I know what he's doing and why he's doing it, but as a graphic designer, one of the things that you do, which is really cool, which a lot of people don't take the time to do, is that you also work on the manuals and things. And so tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, okay. Well, we kind of just want to, when we release a game, I think we all are on kind of the same mindset that we want to release everything that we can that's part of that game's history. I mean, obviously we might not be able to get to things like, you know, posters or flyers or something like that, or magazine stuff that would have promoted the game, but anything that was pretty much an item that was for sale that came with that game, if it's something that might be interesting for the end user to learn about or read about, you know, we want to make it there as part of the set, so to speak, that they can all see when the game is ready. So, for example, like, you know, we're thinking about working on a game called Different Realm. And Different Realm is unique in that it's not just a game, but you also have a manga that was released for it. And you also have apparently a board game, a tabletop RPG.
Wow.
That was also released with it too. And so ideally what we'd like to do is see if we can get everything and at least scan it and put it out there so that when this game comes to light, you know, anybody that is interested in it can find all the details.
We don't even know if the tabletop RPG exists at this point. We've been trying really hard to find it, but, like, we can't even find an ISBN number or, like, any mention of it except that it apparently exists. So it's going to be tough.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're checking stuff like Yahoo Auctions and Suruga Yad and trying to find if it ever pops up mysteriously.
Even worse is that we've recently found out that there was a novelization of the game that we also have no further information about aside from mention of it on a poster for the game. So there's a lot for that one.
Oh, no. That's a whole other little side story, is that a lot of the games that were really popular at the time had, like, adventure novels, like choose-your-own-adventure novels and stuff. And I've got a few of them here.
Yeah.
I've actually got one for Tower of Druaga, and I've got one for Valkyrie... Nobulkin, Valkyrie Adventure, I guess you would call it. And then I've got one for... There's one for Metroid that I don't have. I've got one for the original Gundam series, where you're like Char, and you run around and like jump into different mobile suits and stuff. It's really, really interesting. But there was a whole series of those, all based around different video games.
Yeah, they had a Zelda, they had a Metal Gear, they had Back Xanadu, they had all kinds of ones. A lot of them were for NES.
Yeah, there was a lot of them for NES games. And they're really clever because, unlike American ones where they – I don't know if you've gotten to see any of these, but unlike American ones where they are very just sort of turn to this page, turn to this page. These have like little rules – like little character sheets that you print out. You can like photocopy them, and you have like actual stats and things, and you can actually get into little battles and stuff in the storyline of the game, and you have to like keep track of your items and stuff on this little scorecard. So it's a mix of like the tabletop RPG and the choose your own adventure book. Really neat.
Yeah, what would be amazing though is if there was a an effort to preserve these and do something with them to make, like, I don't know, a website that you could actually interact with. You know, maybe it keeps track of all that information that you need to, and it knows where you are and your decisions, and it lands you on that page, and it's essentially following a script.
That would be really cool. Yeah, I know that the aforementioned person does have a lot of those books in his collection, but a lot of them are not that hard to come by. Some of them get a little expensive, but they're not horribly hard to come by, so maybe that'd be a good project for me to look out for. So before I wrap up this episode about the PC-98, I just want to take one last moment to say that this PC, more than any other Japanese PC that I've worked with, is the first to really bring out the sort of technical heart and soul of computing for me. You know, I actually started out, first of all, with a laptop that was technically a PC-98, although it was one of the later models that was mostly incompatible. And I did spend some time working with that, but I didn't get very far with it because it had a few problems. And again, wasn't PC-98 software compatible. But unlike the first Japanese computer systems that I had after that, which were the MSX and then later the PC-88, you know, I didn't really have a lot of hardware that I had to deal with. You know, with the PC-88, I did have a problem because my first one had some hardware issues that it basically just died. And that was something that was not really related to the PC-88 in a technical sense. But in general, there's just not a lot that you do with those systems. I mean, if there's something wrong with the PC-88, you can repair it, or you can change some capacitors or things like that if you need to. Maybe change out a floppy drive. But there's not too much of that going on, again, unless there's a problem. With the MSX, even less so. You really don't have very many opportunities to take apart your MSX computer unless you just really, really need to, or if it needs cleaning, or if it needs some work. And most of the MSX systems don't really need that. Maybe they need some repair with the keyboard. Maybe they have a floppy drive problem. But PC-98, more than any other computer that I've worked with here in Japan so far, is a system where it's never complete. It is a system where there is always something to do to it. You can always upgrade it. You can always install something new, like a new sound card or a MIDI card or some new RAM. And depending on what model you've got, you know, you can take a 286 and turn it into a 486 with an add-on chip. There's so many things that you can do with these systems. And I've had to put a lot of time and effort into getting these systems to work. And that sounds like a challenge, and it definitely was, but it was a very fun challenge because more so than with the MSX or the PC-88, I've had a lot of opportunities to talk with people and make friends. And this group in particular with the Discord, where I have met these fun members of 46 Okamen here, you know, I've had opportunities to sit down and just talk tech with people because they knew more information than I did. And it's a real shame in a lot of ways that this information isn't out there generally known. A lot of it comes from either people who translated something from Japanese or, more commonly, people who just sat around and messed with stuff and happened to have the just right technical knowledge to figure out, hey, this is what these, you know, jumper switches do, or, you know, this is where you need to install this, or this bus does this thing and that, and it gets very, very technical. But the feeling that you get when you put one of these systems together and it works and it does something that no other Japanese computer system really can do, it plays some song or music that just blows you away. The time when I installed Windows 3.1 on one of my PC-98 systems and then installed the sound card and then installed a bunch of other stuff and suddenly was able to put in a CD-ROM with an MP3 file and play Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from 1996 through my Roland Ederall speakers connected to my PC-98 machine running Windows 3.1. There is nothing that can top that kind of nostalgic feeling for something that you don't even have real nostalgia for because you didn't own it at the time. And that's beautiful. Being able to recapture a nostalgia that you weren't able to live the first time. It's truly remarkable, and to me, in all of Japanese computers, the PC-98 is the only system that delivers that. So I want to thank all of the members of 46 Okamen for coming and talking, and we'll be talking to them more later when we discuss Rusty in an upcoming podcast. There will probably be at least one episode in between then, but stay tuned for that. They have some interesting stuff to say about this game, and it's a game that really deserves your attention. Lastly, I just want to say that their website is 46okumen.com. That's the number 46okumen.com. All one word. 46okumen.com. And there you can find links to the PC-98 Discord, which is where I got all of my information and met a whole lot of people, and really is in a lot of ways the birth of this podcast. And as an extra bit of news, Doors and Dungeons can now be found on the iTunes podcast directory. So if you normally subscribe to things through iTunes, you can find us there. Just search for Doors and Dungeons. And as always, You can go find us on Twitter at DoorDun Podcast. That's at Door, D-U-N, Podcast. And this week I want to play you out with something just a little bit special that I found while making this podcast. This is the opening song to the anime Shoujo Kakume Utena, and this has been rearranged on PC98's FM Synthesis. So please enjoy, and we'll see you next time.